Comics in Motion is thrilled to be partnering with Humble to become Humble Partners. If you follow the link in the show notes, you'll be taken to Humble Bundle, where you can get some access to some amazing stuff. Digital comics, digital books, video games, coding manuals. The amount of stuff that you can get there is obscene. Plus, you get it at a ridiculous discount. So here's what you need to do. Click that link, go to Humble Bundle. Not only are you going to get great stuff at a great deal, but you're also going to support a charity and you're going to help Comics in Motion keep the lights on. So click the link, go to Humble Bundle, get yourself some amazing stuff. Thanks.
Greetings, everybody! Welcome to episode 15 of Mandatory Marvel and DC, the show that likes to take a look back at the biggest and best storylines from the big two of comics. I'm your host, Max Byrne, and I hope you'll continue to join me each and every episode as we cover these classic moments that have stood the test of time and crossed over into popular culture. Now, for episode 15, I am beyond delighted to welcome back to the show a man that has appeared on here almost as much as me. It's the host of the wonderful Indie Comics Spotlight show. It's easily the sanest man in the state of Florida right now. It's our friend from across the ocean. Yes, it's the man that has forgotten more about comics than the rest of us will ever know. It's the transatlantic titan, the one-man American Armageddon. It's Mr. Tony Farina. Tony, how are you, sir?
Oh, Max, I honestly, it's like I get goosebumps listening to you do that. It's like, I was like, man, I'm going to maybe clip you saying the only sane man in Florida. I really do feel like my wife and I are the only sane people here. It's nuts out there. I was out there today. And it's just like, I don't understand people. What are you doing? Like yesterday there was like where I live, the tropical storm is blowing by, and on the news you see like people who live on boats who refuse to get off boats, even though there was true a guy's boat stuck under a bridge and he wouldn't, they like had to force him to leave. Like, your boat is stuck under a bridge, like that shit's insured, man. Get off the boat.
Yeah,
you will die when the boat gets sucked under the bridge the rest of the way.
It's nuts.
So I appreciate you saying that. And hopefully this book that we're covering will help us just fix 2020.
It will indeed. It will indeed. Yeah. So anything been happening in America the last couple of weeks, Tony? I've not really heard much news coming out of your small country recently.
No? Yeah, there's nothing. I don't even know. Nothing to report. There's not a megalomaniac trying to deny reality. None of that's happening. Everything's normal. Everything's fine. We're just moving along. I don't know. Anything strange for you? I did hear, though, in your country that your friends to the north are pissed and are thinking about leaving again. I heard there may be another Scottish referendum. So I feel like sometimes when I hear other countries are going through crazy shit, it doesn't make me feel as bad living in America right now. Yeah. No offense. I'm not trying to wish ill on you and your country, but it's like, oh, good. There's other things that are nuts happening in the world. It's not just us.
Yeah, I think wherever you could throw a pin in a map right now and you'll find something nuts going on, to be honest with you.
No doubt.
Yeah. Oh, man, what a crazy world we're living in. We're locked down here in the UK as we record this for the next month or so, you know, and we'll see what early December brings. Will they bring us out of lockdown? Will they not? Will we be able to see any of our loved ones at Christmas? Christ knows. But hey, you know. At least we got our health, kind of.
Maybe. As long as you wear a fucking mask.
Yeah, exactly. I'm still above ground, so hey, that's a bonus, isn't it? Yeah.
Right, we have not become mole people.
No. Not yet. Well, like you said, anyway, we'll not delve into the myriad of problems facing the modern world. We'll go back into the comic book world, which is why we're here, and is much more enjoyable. So, as always, and you are, like I said before, you've been on the show a number of times by now. So, as you know, the guest always picks the book or the story arc for the topic of the show. So, Tony, what have you selected for this show?
Well, I have selected the book that, and I know we'll talk about this, but one of the books that's really important to me as an adult comic book reader, Flashpoint. Which rebooted the DC Universe, sort of, and we didn't know it at the time. That's what was going to happen, which is what made it even more fascinating. So it's this is kind of the point, was this 2011 when Geoff Johns really got his hands, when he rolled up his sleeves and was like, all right, give me the ball. And of course, drawn by Andy Kubert, who's always good. And he did the other book we did. So apparently he did the X-Men, or he did the 1602. So I guess Kubert's my guy. Yes. He's great. So I am a big fan. So anyways, that's what we're going to do. Flashpoint. I feel like it's a good book for us. I thought of it because as you say, this is like the things that stand the test of time. And I think that's actually a worthwhile conversation for us to have about Flashpoint. And does it stand the test of time because of what's happened in the DC universe? And then like, how does that even, how do these old stories, when I listen to your show every week, like your Punisher one that was just on, that was great. And I think of, because you guys mentioned even then how the Punisher doesn't really fit. You, I think your line was he's in his own pocket of the 616.
Yeah.
And that's true. And I think there's, so what does that mean though for him, for Frank across the Marvel universe, but what does it also mean for like these other stories that we've talked about and that you do on your show, the identity crisis or the life and death of Captain Marvel, like how much of that is still canon and how does that, what does that reflect on for us as comic readers? So I just thought because Flashpoint was such a big deal for the DC universe. And then it also had a personal connection for me. I just thought it was a good fit. So that was a long way to just, I could have just said Flashpoint. Sorry.
No, that's all. Well, it's got a bit of a, I've got a bit of a connection with it too. So before I sort of say where I am at with it, what is your connection to it then, Tony? What does it, what significance of this title to you?
It brought me back. It's what got me back. So, when you have kids and you've got younger kids, my kids are adults and yours aren't. And so you know, when you have kids, there's these moments, and every guest I've had, you and I've talked about it, you and your other guests have talked about it. Most people have a moment in time, whether it's 5 years or 10 years or 20 years, whatever, where you are out of comics. Sometimes it's consecutive. Sometimes it's like, I think Brad Flicky said, it's like, when I discovered I liked girls, they didn't like comics, so I gave up, and that we all hear those stories. Whatever it is, I liked boys, I liked girls, I liked people that were real, so therefore I gave up on comics. And the other time when people stop reading comics is when they have families and they're broke and or they don't have the time and attention. So for me, it was more of the first than the second.
Yeah.
So there was just a time from the time I got out of college till, my kids were older that I just didn't read them. So Flashpoint is what brought me back. And and we'll talk about this obviously, but we didn't know this would be the new 52. But the reason I think I love the new 52, and while I know other people hate it for lots of reasons, it was like an invitation. It was like someone sent me something in the mail. They're like, "Hey, Tone, listen, man, we know you've been out of comics for a while, and that makes you sad. But don't worry, we're rebooting. You'll be okay." And so that's why this matters to me, is that it brought me back in and gave me an entry point. And so I'm sure that did that for people who'd never read comics before, but for those of us who kind of missed, 10, 15 years of comics, this essentially wiped that all away. So it's like, oh, good. It doesn't matter.
Well, to be honest, you've kind of literally just quoted what I was going to say. That is literally uncanny, because I think I mentioned this when I guested on Scott Weatherly's 20th Century Geek a couple of weeks ago doing my Desert Island Comics. And I spoke very, very briefly about the new 52 and how, for exactly the same as you, for me, that was my re-jumping on point as well in terms of reading comics on a week by week or month by month basis and being fully immersed in the ongoing continuity. It wasn't like I'd completely stopped. I'd had my time away from it. Like you say, life sometimes takes you away in different directions and, gets in the way of things you want to do sometimes. And I'd done exactly the same sort of through my 20s and what have you. And then, the new 52 was literally my full immersion into the full DC continuity. And obviously this is the gateway to that world. This, without the events of Flashpoint, you don't get the new 52. It fully sets up that new continuity and new sort of timeline, doesn't it? So for me, exactly the same as you, Tony, it was just the tipping point for me to go back into. And like you, I you know, with some exceptions, there was some complete dross in the New 52, but
sure.
Yeah. But there,
Superman
but,
and jeans. Yeah. Oh, everybody loves that. Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
Man. Yeah. I'd less said about that, the better, I think, but
okay.
Yeah.
So I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's no different from any era. There's always some stuff you don't like, but I think when the New 52 was at its best, I think it was fantastic. It really was. You know, a lot of people didn't like the direction they took, and, you know, we'll talk about that as we go on, but I thoroughly liked it. So if this, for me, like you, Flashpoint holds a very special place in my heart because it was the big event comic, the big bringing all the characters in that really sort of throws away the established continuity and creates this completely new one via the events of this book, and away we go with the New 52. So yeah, like you, this is very special for me. It really is. So like you said, it came out in 2011. Now, it's quite unusual because there was a five-issue miniseries published between May and August of 2011. As you said, Geoff Johns, Andy Kubert, Dream Team. But as well as the five-issue miniseries, there was 61 issues in total, because there was a huge amount of, without sort of jumping too far ahead, the events of Flashpoint establish a alternate dark dystopian reality for the characters of the DC universe before it's resolved to a point at the end of the book. So what they did was, this book is, the collected trade is five issues, so it gives you the main story and takes you through the main events. But those tie-in issues completely expanded outwards and showed you the backstories of all the main characters of this version of Batman, of this version of Superman, you know, all the things that shape their life.
Even Sir.
Eben Sir, of course, yeah, because as we'll get to, he never crash-landed and died on Earth, so never in this reality, never passed the power ring on to Hal Jordan, who never became Green Lantern. He's just a fighter pilot in this instance, isn't he? So yeah, those books really put more meat on the bone, and are well worth a read. I highly recommend them to anyone who's got them or got access to them. You'd really, if you like Flashpoint, you will love those tie-in books. They are fantastic. But I think for the purpose of this show, we're just talking about the main five issue narrative and what goes on there, which is, you know, an all self-contained story, but it is fantastic.
Yeah,
I think
it is. It's such a cool idea. Yeah. Because I even think it starts by saying, like, this isn't Elseworlds, this is real. Like they have to remind you. Because at this point, Elseworlds had been around, and there were some, you know, Elseworlds. You and I have talked about this before. I think Elseworlds are great. Like, Gotham by Gaslight is...
Oh, yeah, I love Elseworlds.
That is just like, I know, that's like, there's so many perfect Elseworld titles.
Yeah.
And this isn't that. So I like that they're saying, no, don't be deceived by what you see. This is your Barry Allen, who we brought back to life in Final Crisis. This is your Barry Allen. And that's the other thing, too, is Final Crisis happened... What during my dark period?
Yeah.
So I didn't, like, Barry was dead for 23 years in real time, and he came back to life while I wasn't reading comics.
Yeah.
Like I read that after this. So for me, this is also the way that Barry came back to me, was with Flashpoint.
Yeah. There's so much going on in this book. My God, I think half the fun of this book is when you get further into story is waiting to be introduced, or should I say reintroduced, to all your favorite characters and seeing what this version of them is about, you know, because obviously you know all the big hitters of the DC universe are in this book, and we all know them inside out. We know who they are. We know what they're about. We know the backstories. But then here you get just everything's just flipped completely on its head, completely 180 from what you'd expect to see. And that's half the fun, I think, of this book, is waiting for, you know, oh, when's Superman going to turn up, and who's he going to be? What's he going to be? And obviously we'll get to that, you know, the Batman, I mean, they couldn't be more different. You know, why are Aquaman and Wonder Woman destroying the world as part of this, in effect, World War III between the two of them? What's driven that? So that's half the fun. Just waiting, isn't it, for your favorite character to turn up, and so many do. I mean, the depth of the world Johns creates in this book is quite something, isn't it? Because although he's playing with all your existing characters, he's literally created a new universe for them to live in, hasn't he?
Yeah, well, and what he did too is he not only did all that, everything you said, but he also, like, acknowledges that some characters just don't really exist. I mean,
yeah.
Like you talk about without Bruce, what happened to Dick?
Yeah.
That's not addressed. You have to just, as a reader, you have to like wrap your mind around that.
Yeah.
That in this world that is this hellscape, you know, is Dick, maybe Dick, you know, when you just read these five, maybe you're like, well, maybe Dick's parents didn't die. Maybe his life is actually better.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. You have to like, so there's just such, it's such an interesting, he really does make, like you said, the fun is waiting to see who shows up next. And then, you know, was it like issue 3 or 4? This is when Wildstorm gets brought in and Grifter's there.
Yes.
You're like, what? And so it's like, so the way that he just keeps, it's relentless. And who's important demon shows up later. So yeah. It's like he just had full range of the DC universe and just got to play. And like you said, it's, as much as it's a tragedy, the story is a tragedy, in a lot of ways it is a lot of fun because it is a place for nerds to go and be like, man, you know, this is the history of the DC universe is all laid out in front of you. And, so there's a lot of like Easter egg specific nerd things, but yeah. Also if this was the first comic series you'd ever read, if you'd never read a superhero book and the first thing you read was Flashpoint, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
This world, he does such a great job world building and at no point does anybody like super exposition man, you know, there's like enough exposition, but not enough to bog it down. So it's just, it's tight. It's yeah. So fun. It's so great.
It is. And I think, Geoff Johns, I don't think anyone does an event book better than him, really. I think he's a master at that kind of thing. You know, when you look at his sort of his catalogue, his repertoire, he did Infinite Crisis, Blackest Night, most recently Doomsday Clock, 52, things like that. And obviously he's just finished off a short run of 3 Jokers, which has sort of blown everyone's mind. And I think he's just the, when it goes, and obviously he did as well, the one shot that ended the New 52 and set up the Rebirth era as well.
Right, which is what you did on Scott's show.
Yeah. Which what I did on Scott's show, yeah, which again pulls together the world as you know it and just sets you off on a new continuity. And I just think that's the genius of Johns as a writer. His knowledge of the DC universe is obviously borderline encyclopedic. I mean, it, you know, next to Steve, our mutual friend Steve Ray, I've never known anyone who seems to just know every character inside out. It's astounding, really. I mean, his writing and the way he can pull the most seemingly insignificant character and put them into an important situation. It's genius, really. And I suppose, you know, like I said on Scott's show, really, there has been a lot of accusation and innuendo recently about Geoff Johns and his alleged conduct towards others and the way he's treated people. And, you know, I'd like to address the fact that here we're talking about Johns the writer, not the man. You know, we are purely talking about his undoubted skill as a writer. Regardless of the thing, the truth will come out where that's concerned, and then we can all judge the outcome of that, you know, and if what
right,
is...
Right, and that yeah. Can change, right, and that does absolutely matter, because it's stuff that he's being accused of is not as horrific as, you know, as other stuff that other people have done.
Yes.
In the comics world. You know, he's nothing... You know, he's essentially, it seems like he's kind of a dick to people. Yeah. And, okay, it's possible. Is he a giant dick to people? Maybe. We'll find out. Like you said, that'll come out. I think that'll all come out and we'll find out. And, you know, I don't want any, you know, you don't treat people like that, you know?
No.
And again, I think I don't think it'll even be the court of a public opinion. I think, well, all of this will eventually come out and we'll see and we can judge. He's not physically harmed anyone. He's not, you know, a mass murderer or anything. He's, you know, I think there's something about people who achieve greatness.
Mm.
There's different kinds of people handle that differently. Like not everybody can be Jim Lee. Not everybody can handle that.
Yeah.
In the way that Jim Lee handles it. For some people you crack. Some people, you know, we all.
Yeah.
Shit happens to us and we vent at people and we blow off steam and one person rubs us the wrong way. So you yell and scream at that person. Again, that doesn't make it okay. I'm not defending him, but yeah, I agree with you. It's like, until we know for sure, I feel fine reading his work because we really don't know anything.
Yeah, exactly. And where that happens and, you know, like you said, the truth of all his alleged conduct will become out. And if, you know, if it proves to be true, then shame on him. What a you know, what, like you said, what a dick. And if it's not true, then I greatly feel sorry for the man having his name dragged through the mud. But either way, that's a separate issue to what we're talking about here tonight as we record. We're talking about this book, and specifically his skill as a writer. We're not talking about the man. We're talking about what he can, what, you know, his work. So I think it's important to sort of put that out there.
Sure.
Yeah. But yeah, obviously this book, it's, you know, a roller coaster ride. So we don't want to get too spoilery on this show, but essentially the sort of opening premise is that Barry Allen sort of wakes up at his desk at the police department, and life as he knows it, as we know it as readers, has been completely altered. Fundamentally, his mother, Nora, who was obviously murdered by Reverse Flash when he was a child, is now alive. He doesn't have his Flash powers, and the world is seemingly going to hell in a handbasket. Quite a great opening, really. And you know, it's great that throughout this book, you sort of led down a specific path, aren't you? The Reverse Flash is the ultimate red herring, isn't he? Because you're constantly sort of led to believe that all this situation is his creation, only for at the very end, the rug gets pulled out from you. You find out that actually Barry created this situation by what he did and seemingly forgotten about. It's quite an interesting twist on it, isn't it? That the person you built up to be the villain is literally not the villain of this.
Yeah, I think what I've always, and that was so smart, because I think any Flash fan, you know, Flash has, you know, you could argue who's got the best rogues, Bruce or Barry. Mm. And they're it's 1 and 1A. I mean, you catch me on the day, who do I think's got the better rogue gallery? You know, yeah. I think they're both just, I don't know, whoever, you know, in the day, in the Silver Age, when these guys were getting all their baddies, people, whoever was writing Flash or Batman were like, we don't care about anybody else. We just want these people to have amazing villains.
Yeah.
Who are equal to the hero in a lot of ways, who know exactly what to do. But of course, of all of the baddies, Thawne, Reverse Flash, is the worst of the worst. And, yeah, you know, I had those original issues when Barry breaks his neck way back when.
Yeah.
I had those. And I remember that cover, you know, like the trial of the Flash and all of that. And just like the way that Thawne has just really screwed with Barry his whole life. And so it was such good writing, because anybody who's reading this is like, instantly you're going to be like, yeah, of course it was Thawne. You know, Captain Cold couldn't pull this off, and Mirror Master couldn't, but there was only one person who could and who has, he's such a cold-blooded killer.
Yeah.
Literally, he kills Nora. Yeah. And so it's like perfect. It's such a great dodge. And then at the end, it's heartbreaking, because it makes perfect sense too, that this would be Barry's fault, because Barry's whole life, he thinks, is ruined because Nora died, and that, yeah, Henry dies in jail and all this stuff. And so you're just like, oh man, you know, of course Barry would do it. His heart was totally in the right way, right place when he did this.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes it such a compelling story for us as readers. Cause like I was saying earlier, like what happens to Dick when you read these, you don't know.
Yeah.
What's Dick Grayson's, but you know that Barry Allen, while the world is falling apart, Barry Allen's life was way better.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, he had his family together, didn't he? Like you said, mom's alive, dad's not in prison serving life for her murder, which of course he didn't do anyway. And granted, he never got to become the Flash, but he had his family around him. So, you know, you'd trade one for the other, wouldn't you? But I suppose that was a question I was going to ask you, really, was in Barry going back in time to obviously thwart the death of his mother. Was he being really selfish, or was he being really fucking dumb, you know? Because surely someone like Barry Allen would appreciate the fact that if you go back in time and change something, then the ripples in time, the butterfly effect, you know, you, such a critical path that you're altering, you know, the ramifications are going to be huge. And obviously, as we'll get to, the ramifications are universe spanning. So, you know, where do you stand on it? Should he have known better, or?
Well, Barry Allen, the scientist, should have 100% known better.
Yeah.
And Barry Allen's not he's, other than Bruce Wayne and Tim Drake, he's the smartest guy in the DC universe, right?
Yeah.
Vic Stone is up there, obviously, you know, but you always wonder how much of Vic's brain is human brain, and yeah, as opposed, you know, So, and Vic obviously plays a huge role in this, and I love Vic, and we'll talk about him too, I know. But so I'm always on the fence. Like, the scientist Barry Allen would have told someone else not to do this. But because Barry's always the guy who wears his heart on his sleeve, I think he analyzed it. You know how, like, you convince yourself of anything. You can convince yourself that whatever it is isn't that terrible.
Yeah.
And so I think he thought, well, what is the significance of Nora Allen and Henry Allen's life? He didn't think about what is the significance of Barry Allen's life, what the Flash means for the DC universe. He didn't think about how we learn of parallel Earths because of Barry Allen. He doesn't think about how he's always the positive member of the Justice League. He's the guy who brings joy to a pretty dour situation.
Yeah.
So he doesn't think about that because he's only thinking, well, he doesn't realize, well, I'll still be a scientist. The accident will still happen to me, but my mom will be alive. And I don't think he could see what ripple effects her life.
Yeah.
I think that's what he thought. It's like, well, who's she? She's just a nobody. It'll only affect me and my dad, so it'll be fine. And he didn't think it through. So you could say it's really dumb in hindsight and he should know better, but because he's such a nice guy and it's been such a hard thing for him and he has all this power. And it's such a great question is, if you had all the power, what would you do?
I know. I think you'd have to be a pretty strong-willed, righteous person to not want to try it. You know, I think at the end of the book, Bruce even says to him, you know, when he says, don't beat yourself up over all this, you know, because Bruce even says to him, if I had your power, I would try and do the same thing and save my mum and dad from that night they were killed.
Yeah.
You know, and he even says to him, don't think I haven't thought about it. As in, like, you can go and fix that for me, kind of thing. You know, Flash could go and be there that night in Crime Alley and stop Joe Chill from killing Bruce's mom and dad and give Bruce his life back that he never had. So I think if we all had the opportunity to go back and fix major disasters in our life or, you know, major crossroads point in our life that our life took a turn for the worst, we'd all do it, wouldn't we? Let's be honest.
Yeah, I think so. Especially when it's this big of a thing. It's not... I mean, Barry grew up essentially an orphan, just like Bruce. Yeah. I mean, this is the cool thing about this too, is that on their face, the Flash and Batman are nothing alike other than they're both real smart.
Yeah.
But this book really makes you take the stark look at the fact that, oh, right, they're both orphans too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they are. Yeah.
Barry's not a traditional orphan. His dad's alive, but it's even worse. You know, like seeing his dad in the prison cell is worse, maybe even than Bruce just having to, you know, visit Thomas and Martha's grave. So I think it is it is telling too, like you said at the end, when Bruce is back and everything is air quotes reset, the fact that Bruce doesn't ask Barry to do it is a testament to the difference between them as people.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think just Bruce has that slightly more rational, think it through, you know, bigger picture mindset, doesn't he? Because he says, like I said, he says, don't think I haven't thought about it. So he obviously, when he thinks about it, he thinks, well, if I do it, shit's going to break, all hell's going to break loose if I do it. So obviously he knows the bigger picture, whereas Barry's just, like you said, acting on impulse. And I know for a fact, if something like that happened to me and I could go back in time and change it, you wouldn't be able to hold me back, you know? So,
yeah.
And I suppose what you were saying is right as well about, you know, just saving the life of his mother, who, you know, no offense to Nora Allen, but she was not a hugely significant person in the grand scheme of things, you know? And so you wouldn't think that her just not being killed that night would create this sort of dystopian reality for the rest of the world, would you? And when you think about it in that scope, because I suppose if you look at it super forensically, and it's almost nitpicking, I suppose, but in this, we'll jump ahead slightly, but in this reality, Superman's rocket didn't land in a Kansas farm field and he was taken in by Jonathan and Martha Kent. In this reality, his rocket crash lands in the center of Metropolis, kills 35,000 people, and he's taken away by the government and spends his life from that point on as a lab rat being experimented on and never sees the light of day until the events of this book. But one would think that when he came to Earth, he was a toddler, a baby in some continuities, right? But Barry's mother was killed when Barry was older than that. Barry was a young boy, but he wasn't a you know, a toddler age. He was older, you know, maybe, you know, 10 or very early teens, something like that, depending on different depictions. So Superman's arrival on Earth would technically have already happened by that point, wouldn't it, if you think about it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So him doing that, why would that... It would... If you go back and change something in the past, it would alter everything that comes after that, because you've changed something, so the world goes in a different path. But surely Superman's arrival on Earth predates Nora Allen's death. So why, in that new reality, is Kal-El's ship not landing in Smallville? I don't quite get that, but I suppose I'm just thinking too much about it.
No, I have a theory. And again, I'm not.
Oh, yeah.
My theory is that Barry Cree is the Speed Force.
Yeah.
Barry invents the Speed Force that we think about now and that's used, like, thrown around on the TV show and in the world, and even in the Snyderverse, the Speed Force is there because we see that version of the Flash. Well, he's not called the Flash. That version of Barry.
Yeah.
Travel through time in Batman versus Superman.
Yeah.
And so we know about the Speed Force, but what again, this goes back to John's like encyclopedic knowledge of the DC universe, is that Barry creates the Speed Force. It's and Thawne brings it up actually in this book, just as, you know, like, that's why I think it's such a good way, even if somebody never knew anything, like, there's just enough exposition to be like, oh, that's a thing. But anyway, so my theory is, because as Barry runs through the Speed Force, he can push a wave out. So it's like literally a ripple effect. And all, like when you throw a stone in the river or in the lake, it doesn't just, the ripples don't just go one way. They go backward and forward.
Yes.
That's my theory. Is that because, so Barry ran to this time when he's 8, let's just say, like you said, it depends on which version. Yeah. We'll just stick with he's 8. So he runs from a 30-year-old man to an 8-year-old boy. So he runs back 22 years. And he stops, and that's the rock that goes plink in the time, in the Speed Force and in the timeline. So there would be then a ripple backward and a ripple forward and all directions. So that's why Abe and Sur doesn't land.
Yes.
That's why everything, like, somehow that ripple, it goes out and up and down. It goes down to Atlantis. It goes to Themyscira. It goes all around the world. That's my theory. I have no idea, but that's just the only way I can get through this.
Yeah, I know what you mean. You can, with anything to do with time travel and cause and effect, you can literally tie yourself up in knots trying to rationalize it and justify it, because there's so many different interpretations of it, depending on what film you watch or what book you read about the effect of going back in time and changing events. Do they only affect the time out, like, what comes after that? Or, like you said, are you, you know, causing a ripple in time that goes backwards, forwards, sideways, and affects everything all there around? So I suppose, yeah, in this instance, that must be the explanation, mustn't it? Yeah, because otherwise, why would Kal-El not land in Smallville? Because Barry's changing time after that event. So, but hey, you know. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, as we've said, Barry going back saves Nora's death at the hands of Reverse Flash and wakes up in this new reality. So he initially has no recollection of having done this, because he's reset time. And throughout this book, actually, his memories are constantly evolving, aren't they? As this new timeline takes hold, he's losing his old memories of what the timeline used to be, quote unquote, the normal DC continuity up to this point. And memories of this Flashpoint universe are starting to ingrain themselves into his psyche, aren't they? So this is, like, I think throughout this book, time is such a theme, isn't it? Because not only do you have that traveling through time, it's like a race against time, A, to stop sort of World War III and the death of the entire human race, and a race of time to stop Barry's memories completely evaporating. And if he forgets the timeline, then no one remembers it and no one will reset it. So it's like a ticking clock effect in this book, isn't there?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think what is fantastic about it too, is that it is a race against time, is that for the first few issues, Barry doesn't have his power. And so he's stuck at normal pokey, slow Barry Allen. Like the cover is always Barry Allen is late to everything.
Yeah.
Now Barry Allen is literally late to everything. And so I like that too, like that play with time. But yeah, because we do see how, as Barry slowly learning, and like you said, this universe is taking hold and becoming the universe. As the man out of time, well, there's, we learn later that there's two men out of time, that Thawne is also out of time as well, that that the memories, you know, that's again where you can tie yourself up and not trying to explain time travel, because what do you know and what don't you know, right? And when you, and I think what's fascinating to me is that he is still, we obviously, on page zero of this, Barry Allen goes back and saves his mom. And then on page one of this, he wakes up, he thinks he's just napping at his desk.
Yeah.
And so what he's for, what the only thing that he's forgotten is the choice to go back and save his mom.
Yeah.
But the rest of the DC universe, he still remembers. And so, like you said, the ripples are, that's that going in backward in time as his memories are being erased, not erased, but replaced.
Yes.
Slowly, you know, backward. So like the most recent thing he did was save his mom. So he doesn't remember that. But then the thing that happened yesterday or 2 days ago, or marrying Iris, he still remembers those things, even though they haven't happened.
Yeah.
And then eventually he'd forget those too.
Yeah. It is. It's again, it's, it, there's so many ways to interpret the cause and effect sort of rationale of this book. It really is. It's a real brain scratcher. Is the word I want to try and use. You know, you can really sort of go up so many different alleys trying to rationalize why things are happening the way they're happening. And it's again, that's a testament to Johns and the way he writes. He's very good at teasing the reader, isn't he? He doesn't put it all out on a plate. He leads you. It's like with the other books I've mentioned, Three Jokers, for instance. He leads you down a certain path to make you think you know what's going on. And you think, okay, this is, I know now why we're at where we're at, and I can see where this is heading. And then he's very good at sort of pulling the rug out. Yeah, pulling the rug out and throwing you in a completely different direction and going, all you thought you know is complete bullshit. You know nothing. This is what happened, or this is what's going to happen. And I think that's the strength of him as a writer, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think what I like is that he doesn't just do sex machina it. He tries to explain it. And like you said, it's time travel. So there's always going to be a little bit of that, of, you know, God in the machine. But he doesn't, what he does is he always tries to give you a reason why the dodge happened. It's not just because comics, you know, he's like, no, I'm going to set this up. And he may have to go back a year or 2 years or 15 years in time, in real time, not in comic book time, to find the thing that he planted in a previous story or in a previous thing to make this happen.
Yeah.
And so I think that's also a testament to him playing the long game. And it could just be, he's like, oh, you know, it was cool. Something I did 5 years ago is this. I'm going to pretend that's the thing. But then that's still not bullshit, because he set it up, because it's real. He's not erasing time. You know how it's like, when you watch a sequel, sometimes the sequel movie, like they're supposed to pretend, like movies I love, and they're terrible, but I love them all. I own them all on Blu-ray, the Resident Evil movies.
Yeah.
The opening scene of each Resident Evil movie kind of scrubs your brain a little to what happened in the last movie, and it resets it.
Yeah.
Except for the last two, which take place essentially in the same time, at the same day, like from back to back.
Yeah.
Every movie is like, Alice's voiceover is trying to trick you into thinking you forgot what happened in the previous movie.
Yeah.
So watching them all six in a row, you're like, wait, that's not what happened. But in real time, it's been 3 or 4 years. So what I appreciate with Johns is he doesn't do that. He doesn't try to scrub it. Whatever it is he did, whether it's an issue one, the reveal in issues five, or whether it's 15 years ago and the reveal now, he's always, the reason those, the, you can, you believe it, you can get the rug pulled out from under you, is because he's never tricked you.
Yeah.
He just has deceived you. And those are different things.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's like you said, it's genius writing, the way he can pick up things he's done several years in the past and use that as the catalyst for where he's going to take it next. Like with the like I did on Scott Show, the DC Rebirth one shot, the events of this book we're talking about now directly frame that, because when it's revealed in Rebirth that the person manipulating the timeline all along was Dr. Manhattan from the Watchmen universe, he's using the end of this book to take you out of the New 52 and into the Rebirth era, but several years apart. I mean, it's, you know, I almost refuse to believe that when he wrote Flashpoint, he said, I'll tell you what, when we next time we reboot the DC universe and change the continuity up, I'm going to use this, and I'm going to use Dr. Manhattan from the Watchmen universe, and I'm going to bring in other characters from that beloved book and, you know, incur the wrath of the Alan Moore hardcore crowd. I refuse to believe at this point in time he had that idea already, but I think he's very good, isn't he, at going back and utilizing what he's already got and, you know, taking it on from there.
I think he thought this would stick.
Yeah.
I think Warner Brothers, here's the thing. The reason I like indie comics so much is that you can create your own universe, and that's the universe. Yeah. This is the world. And if you want to cross them over, like the Image universe, the superhero part of the Image universe crosses over, right? Spawn and Savage Dragon live in the same world. Yeah. Wetworks, they're there. They're all in the same, but the rest of Image isn't. Right.
Yeah.
So if you read an image, if you Kick-Ass doesn't exist in the Savage Dragon world, they're not going to run into each other. So it's okay. What I think the problem with these big companies, with Marvel and DC, is they're constantly trying to find a way to bring in new readers instead of just sustaining the old readers. Obviously, you need growth or you die.
Yeah.
So these reboots have to continue to happen. I really think that everyone thought this was going to be a winner.
Mm.
And so I agree with you. I don't think his plan all along was to do this and then be like, okay, in 5 years, I have to scratch it, because it's 2011 to 2016, right?
Yeah.
So I don't think he planned on New 52 only lasting 5 years.
Yeah.
But because, again, he's willing to, A, you know, well, this is the thing with Warner Brothers and Marvel, is they go where the wind blows. And so sales are lagging. Well, shit, we better do another thing. Let's bring Jeff in. He's good at this. And he's like, oh, I got one image that Kubert did, this splash page at the end of issue 5 of Flashpoint.
Yeah.
I can just use that again. Cool. And show you all the universes merging together. So, yeah, I don't think it was a plan, but I think it goes back to what you said at the beginning about his encyclopedic knowledge, not only of what he's done, but what exists in the DC universe. So he can always go find something. And, you know, unlike Lucas, George Lucas was like, this was always my plan. I agree. I don't think Johns was like, this is my plan. I think he's like, well, what did I do and how can I use that?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think his strength is coming up with original ideas. And like I said earlier, no one does that big event crossover book better than him. You know, that's all down to opinion anyway. It's all subjective, isn't it? But for me,
he's really good.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm curious. I have this question for you as I was rereading this. And I was like, I wonder what Max think of this. And again, this goes back to me just becoming a grumpy old man and thinking the world is almost like the comic book world is a little too big. What did you like the fact that this, while the DC universe exists and there's still the Green Lantern Corps and, you know, the Themyscirians and the Atlanteans are fighting and everything.
Yeah.
So it's air quotes big that way. But the amount of heroes, like the team is tighter. We've lost some kind of supporting cast.
Yeah.
This is when this is what makes Vic his own hero. He no longer is a Titan after this. This is the move, right? From here, he becomes in the Justice League after New 52.
That's right, yeah.
After Flashpoint. So anyway, my point is, what did you think of the fact that the heroes, even like the group that Vic's trying to get together, it's a small group. It's not like the DC universe is just smaller. I kind of like that idea of, it makes these crossover events, I think, feel a little bit more realistic when you're only dealing with 5 or 6 stories instead of, and it's interesting that he goes from having this small universe to literally 52 books, like a few months later.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just, what is your think about that? What do you think about like the current state? I mean, right now we know the DC universe is contracting. They continue to cancel books.
Mm.
And I don't want people to lose their jobs or books to get canceled, but I almost feel like maybe it's a necessary evil that we keep expanding too much. And maybe if you're going to have a shared universe, it has to be small.
Yeah, I think so. I think it just makes it, in terms of this book, I really like the small group because it makes it a more intimate story. Yes, there's this huge global apocalyptic event taking place, but it very much takes place around the principal characters who are ostensibly in this book. Barry, Batman, Thomas Wayne Batman, which we'll get to, not Bruce Wayne, and Vic, really, essentially, they are the three main drivers of the plot through this story, aren't they? And I really like that. I really like that. Rather than it being a huge team and things are taking place all over the world and all over the universe, I much prefer stuff when it's more streamlined. And in terms of what you're saying about, you know, the wider universe now, and like you said, they're cancelling books seemingly every week and really sort of boiling it down now to, you know, books based around the Trinity and various offshoots of those. I suppose, you know, it's a business.
The Green Lanterns are still around.
Green Lanterns as well, yeah, of course, yeah. And the Flash obviously sells his own book. But they go in with what sells, and of course that's fine because it's a business at the end of the day. They've got to make some bloody money. So I can't blame them for that. You can't keep publishing books that don't sell, regardless of how critically acclaimed they are. You know, it's a commercial business. You know, if they don't make the money, they get axed. That's life. But I like you said, although I hate to see books get axed, I like the fact that it's a smaller universe, because when you've got a massive shared universe and everything supposedly is happening in the same continuity and events don't have to tie in because books aren't crossing over, but they still exist in the same continuity. And I think I mentioned this on another show, is that you have Batman in his own title and you have Batman in the Justice League title. And in his own title, he's doing something intimate, street level in Gotham, and you know there'll be an arc where he's literally got his back to the wall and Gotham's on fire and everything's been taken away from him and he's got to fall to his lowest ebb to rise up and take back his city. That's quite a well-worn trope within Batman. But at the same time that book's getting published, there's a Justice League title being published where Batman is front and center member of the Justice League and he's in outer space fighting some alien threat in the far reach of the cosmos. Well, if that's all one shared universe, one shared continuity, how can he be doing both at the same time? Yeah. So I agree with what you're saying. I think it does need to be a smaller universe, but with you can have less titles but still have as much going on. I think sometimes you can have less padding, and yes, it's sad to see titles go with characters you love like Green Arrow and Hawkman, Suicide Squad's
Batgirl.
These are all, but the characters aren't going away is my point, you know. Just because you just because you axe their solo books, it doesn't mean that's the end of that character. They'll continue to crop up in other titles, you know. So that's, and then the beauty of comics is an axe book can always be brought back, you know.
Correct. Yeah. Exactly, you know. Yeah. I was just such a weird juxtaposition to me. So thank you for answering that, because to me it's so funny interesting that Johns does that in this. Like you said, he gets this different Trinity, a different kind of Trinity with Vic and Thomas and Barry, and then, you know, Clark is a minor player in this universe, and because he's not even Clark. Actually, he's not Clark. He's only Kal-El, which I think is a fascinating look. And of course, Diana and Arthur are having, Mira's dead. We find out that Diana kills Mira. I mean, shit's bad. Yeah. And Orm and Arthur are pals. Like, what a crazy thing. And so he really, like you said, it's almost like a claustrophobic world. And while, like you said at the beginning, the world, the flashpoint, where you can then build out and see what happened before Flashpoint happened, kind of like what was happening in the world of Flashpoint, that's cool. And there was your place to expand the universe. But in the main story that he's telling, it's this tight claustrophobic thing with just a handful of characters that you know and love or hate or whatever. And then from that really successful, really interesting thing, then he's like, you know what we're going to do? 52 books.
Yeah.
Like, what are you thinking about? Like, and some of those books were really good.
Oh, yeah.
But like you said, well, 52 books, 8 of them are Batman books. Well, no. Sometimes don't give people what they want. Then they'll buy the thing that you have.
Yeah, exactly.
If you think you have to have Batman or Harley. Yeah. If you think you have to have, like, the Batman Superman comic, that should be once every so often, once a year, you do a Trinity crossover. You know, like a mini series where literally the events of like what you and Dave did, Craven's Last Hunt, that crossed over the three Spider-Man titles.
Yeah,
it was the shared universe. Whereas Web of Spider-Man, Spectacular Spider-Man, and Amazing Spider-Man were running Spider-Man titles where different things were happening, but then they were just like, fuck it, we're going to cross it all over and it's going to be one book, one story that crosses over. You know, you're going to like tighten it up before you, I don't know. It's just such a weird thing to me. And again, I think you're, like you said, it's a business. So you're like, well, if we have 52 books, that's more opportunity to make money. But I submit, if you have 20 really good books, then you'll sell 50,000 copies every month.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
you know, I don't know. So I just found it weird that he went from this kind of storytelling to that kind of storytelling. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I totally agree with you. People have only got so much money to spend. And, you know, people who want to spend money on comics will spend the same amount of money. You know, people can't afford to buy 52 books. I mean, people can't afford to buy 20 books. I know, right. I know I couldn't, but
I couldn't. Yeah,
you'll still sell the same amount over the whole piece because there's not more people out there spending more money. If that makes sense, you know, it's 52 books.
Yeah.
52 books there. Well, your average Joe, who's a comic book fan, who's, you know, just an average person earning average money like most of us, you go, well, okay, it's 52. Well, I can buy five of them. So what five do I get? You know, Jesus. Like you said, I'm a huge Batman fan. Therefore, there's eight Batman books. Well, I'll buy just five Batman books because that's all I can afford. So I'll just read Batman. But then I'm missing out on what's going on with Superman, what's going on with the Justice League, what's going on with The Flash, what's going on with Aquaman, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas, like you said, if you give people less range, then they can read more because, you know, you don't have to just buy Batman books. You can buy, well, okay, well, I'll buy Batman and I'll buy Detective Comics. But I'll buy Action Comics. I'll buy Justice League Dark, something like that, you know? So you can mix it up if you give them less choice. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and I just think it's so interesting because to me, that's what Flashpoint was. It was, he was taking all the choice away from us. He was saying, I'm rebooting this universe and I'm shrinking it down and I'm showing you what it can look like when there's just a few characters and how it can be excellent storytelling and all the beautiful things you said about it. And I'm not trying to turn the show into like some referendum on me being a grumpy old man. I'm just saying, like, it was so stark when I went back and reread this weekend. It was like, man, it's such a great story and it's so claustrophobic. And this is, like you keep saying, he's a crossover master. And what makes this an excellent crossover is William Faulkner said, kill your darlings, right? So like he did, he literally killed his darling. Bruce Wayne is not in this book except for five pages at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
Clark Kent doesn't exist in this universe.
Yeah.
He's just Kal-El. So it's just like such a smart, it's so good. And it's, I guess that's what, seeing how good this is and how good it could be, it makes me just kind of frustrated. So while I'm sad, and I think I just saw today on the day we're recording this, which is the 12th of November, Cecil Castellucci tweeted more people. There's more layoffs at Warner Brothers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so again, that makes me sad because I don't want people to lose their job. However, if that means better writing like this, if we're going to get more awesome shit like Flashpoint, then I guess as a consumer, I'm pretty excited.
Yeah, me too. You know, like we said, sometimes you can get too flabby a universe, I think. So I think it's sometimes...
too flabby.
If that makes sense, you know.
I love that phrase.
Too much fat on the bone, you know. Whereas
too much love handles on the universe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you know, sometimes the more intimate you make it, the more I resonate with it. I think, you know.
Yeah,
but that's why
this is so good.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. But one thing that is so good about this book is, like we've sort of touched on, is these different versions then of the characters that we've come to know and love over the years. Many, many years previous to this and generations previous to this. So let's talk about some of these different versions of the characters then. I mean, let's start with, you've already mentioned there, Superman. So he isn't Superman. He is, in this book, no, I think he's known as Subject One, because as we've said, his life took on different trajectory because he wasn't found by the Kents and raised on a Smallville farm and hence doesn't become the world's greatest hero. Instead, lands in Metropolis, government immediately scoop him up, and he spends his entire life being studied and prodded and poked underground. So when you actually first get to, he's spoken about, because obviously Barry's thinking, well, I need to get some people here. Let's get Superman because he's the biggest and best, you know? So when they actually find out what's happened to Kal-El, it's quite a striking image, isn't it, to see him, because he's this emaciated, skinny, incredibly sad-eyed figure when you're always used to seeing Kal-El as this incredibly like perfect buff specimen with hope radiating off him. So what a brave twist, I suppose, to give us this version of the character.
I think it's so smart across the board with all of the variants of our, especially of the Trinity. I love what they do. And I think it's really smart too, to get Superman in the book, but also to remove him from the equation. Yeah. It allows other people to shine as heroes, allows Vic Stone to be the hero that he is. But I also think it also reminds us, I feel like people are always like, oh, the Superman problem. You know, Superman's so powerful, he's boring. Well, we learn in Red Sun, which is one of the best Elseworlds, you and I have talked about, but I mean, God, that's such a great Elseworlds, is the Bruce in that, who stops the Kal-El in that, he traps him underground and puts Red Sun on him, literally. Yes. So it's just like, that's what this is. And so I just love that. I love that image. And of course, you're like, it also is a testament to the Kents, right? The Kents are... you know, they loved him and they made him this big strapping young man that you see. It's not just because he's Superman. It's because he's raised by people who loved him and he's healthy.
Yeah.
Like you said, he's not sad. Like sad-eyed is such a great description of it because he just is, he's an abused child. Mm. And it's striking, but also, again, great storytelling because he's reminding us, and Kubert, again, who's a genius artist, but it's like reminding us of what could have been if the Kents were to have raised him. Think about what a better human he'd be.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, prior to them getting him, he is the ultimate blank slate, isn't he? Because he's an alien, let's not forget, he's an alien being who has literally been whisked away from his exploding planet as a baby. So he's, at that point, hasn't even begun to form a personality or had, you know, understand the influence of others. So like you said, I mean, they've done it before in other Elseworlds, haven't they? They've told stories where, oh, what if he'd landed on a different part of the world, like you say, Red Sun, or they did a story, The Nail, didn't they? An Elseworlds story where Jonathan and Martha can't get a flat tire that day they're out driving when he crashes, so they don't physically get there when he crashes, and he's instead taken in by an Amish family and raised in seclusion on an Amish community. So it's taught to be a good man by those good people, but because they keep themselves to themselves, he never ventures out into the world and becomes Superman. Yeah, so it's great. I like that about the way they can sometimes do that with the character. It's the ultimate what if, isn't it? You know, I know it's a Marvel trademark, but what if?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, because and like you said, he's an alien, but we forget that. And this is a conversation everybody has, you know, about Clark. Clark is a human. Clark Kent is a man.
Yeah.
Super Kal-El, Superman, is an alien.
Yeah.
And the person, the character is Clark Kent. Superman is the alter ego.
Mm.
And in this, he doesn't have that opportunity to learn what humanity is and to be a man. And I think that conversation that we have when we see him is that humanity isn't about where you're from. It isn't about what country you're from or what planet you're from. It's about how you were raised.
Yeah.
And so he's literally raised as an abused animal. And you see they kill Crypto.
Yeah, you see a skeleton, don't you?
Yeah. And so, and it's like, well, fuck, how do you kill Crypto? Right. Well, you keep them locked away from the sun. Their power comes from the sun.
Mm.
And it was really a beautiful, I mean, it's a horrific image, but it was like a beautiful, like, love letter to what you think you know. And I think it was just a reminder of how much we take Clark Kent for granted, not just Superman, but Clark Kent for granted.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you said as well, the fact that they keep him underground so he never gets that nourishment. So he's literally like a bag of bones, isn't he, when they meet him?
So disgusting.
Yeah.
So great.
He's almost like he's been kept in like a death camp kind of situation, isn't it? But then you get that ultimate sort of when they obviously, you know, when they bust him out and help him escape, when he finally ventures out into like fresh air, and it's like the ultimate sensory overload, isn't it? You know, he starts to rise off the ground. He flies, presumably for the first time. You know, he uses his heat vision on the soldiers that have presumably
kills them
because they've probably been party to his abuse over the years, you know, and then flies off. I mean, you know, it's like ultimate, like, caterpillar into butterfly moment, isn't it?
Well, it was another thing that Johns does is he sets you up thinking, oh, well, they're going to Kal-El, everything's fine. And then he's like, swoop. And Thomas Wayne's like,
Yeah.
You know, he's like, of course that happened. So it was just like, and Barry was genuinely shocked that that's what happened.
Yeah.
But of course it would happen.
Yeah, of course it would. Well, Barry's only known, like you said, the Clark Kent, who's the best of us because he was raised by such wonderful people and taught the best of values. Whereas this is a man, I should say by now, who's only seen the worst of humanity, hasn't he? Who's never known love and affection, and is fearful of everyone because everyone in his life has probably treated him with contempt and done God knows what kind of experiments on him and kept him under lock and key. So just because they've busted him out, he has no loyalty to them. He's not going to go, okay, I'll stand and fight with you and we'll...
Why would he?
Yeah, exactly. Why would he? He'd just run off and escape. And, you know, if I was him, I'd go and hide and never come back. I mean, ultimately, we know he does come back at the end and plays a key part in the end battle and, you know, does some very quote-unquote Superman type things. But, you know, I think his reaction is completely natural. I mean, I'd do exactly the same if I was him.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. It's a good take. And speaking of interesting takes, and obviously the sort of the main one and the one that's endured the most from this book and has been resurrected in recent years is this version of Batman, which, as we know, isn't Bruce Wayne. So basically in this continuity, the night that the Waynes were murdered down that fateful crime alley by Joe Chill.
You may have seen it once or twice in media. Once or twice.
It may have been mentioned in every fucking Batman film that's ever been made. It may have been depicted. Yeah. I'm sure we'll get a lovely montage of it in the Matt Reeves, Robert Pattinson, Batman film as well when that comes out.
I hope so. I hope not. I hope they resist the urge.
Yeah, we don't need to see it. Much the same as Marvel did a good thing by not showing the death of Uncle Ben in Tom Holland's Spider-Man.
It was such a smart line. He's like, yeah, I got bit by a spider. And that was it. You're like, thank you.
Yeah,
smart.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, those characters are so well-worn, we don't need to see how they came to be.
Yeah.
But anyway, in this reality, then that event still takes place, but by a sort of twist of fate, rather than Thomas and Martha Wayne being assassinated, it's unfortunately the child Bruce Wayne that gets killed. Thomas and Martha survive, and the child Bruce is murdered. And that sets his parents off on the most divergent of paths I think you could ever go on, in that Thomas becomes this continuity's Batman. And although it isn't actually given to you within this five-issue arc, it's very much given to you in the aforementioned tie-in issues, is that Martha is literally driven insane with grief and trauma by, obviously, the horrific event that she's had to bear witness to, and becomes this reality's version of the Joker, which is crazy
so
to say this, but it works very well. And in those tie-in issues, the interaction between the two of them as Batman and Joker, who used to be loving husband and wife, it's brilliant to see. I mean, the tragic quality of it and the way that particular relationship ends and Martha's descent into utter madness is really effective storytelling. I highly recommend people pick that up. But in this, you don't even get told that. You just think, well, where is Martha?
Right.
Yeah. And the Joker isn't seen either.
Right, and what's smart is that they refer to the Joker and never use a gender. This I made sure I checked this time. At no point does Thomas ever use a pronoun when referring to the Joker. It's just always the Joker, the Joker, the Joker.
Yeah.
It was so smart. What a setup for the punch that comes later. Yeah.
It is great. And obviously this version of Batman is the normal version of Batman's a dark character at the best of times, but this version of Batman makes the mainstream continuity Batman almost look like Superman because he's so much darker. He's incredibly violent. He's no compunction about killing criminals, unlike, you know, our regular Batman. He carries a gun, let's not forget. He does some pretty heinous stuff. I mean, the first time you see him, he literally throws sort of a kind of version of Harley Quinn off a skyscraper with no intention of catching her, with no intention of sort of throwing her onto the back of a bin lorry or something like that. He literally is throwing her to her death before she is ultimately saved by another character who we'll mention in a bit. But this is a dark, dark version of Batman, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think it's really smart because what you learn is, and as a parent, it's, what happens to Bruce is tragic. What happens to Barry is tragic. They lose their parents when they're young. Mm. And this is about losing your child. And it's a different trauma. Yeah. It's different. Bruce had Alfred. Mm-hmm. Bruce, and it, not to say that it's good to lose your parents, but Bruce had Alfred. Bruce then saves Dick, and he saves, you know, Jason, and he tries to like help these people and who are in similar situations. And so, but the trauma of losing a child, and especially because there's one scene in this book where it looks like Thomas is attacking Joe, and when he does, that's why the gun shoots Bruce. Like it's a, if he had just stood there, you know, then, you know, it's like, because he's in this version, he's fast enough to move Joe's arm, where in the real version, he's not fast enough. And so he gets shot. Like he reaches for him, but he gets shot. In this version, he's fast enough to just alter the course of the bullet. So he blames himself too. So not only does he lose his son, but he blames himself, even though Joe Chill pulls the trigger. It's clear, it's not explicitly said in these five issues. But in that one panel, beautifully drawn by Kubert, it's like, oh, fuck, he blames himself. So it's such a deep look at trauma and what you're willing to do. So, of course, he's dark because he's not interested in justice now. He's only interested in vengeance.
Exactly, yeah. And it's, you know, in his civilian life as Thomas Wayne as well, he's taken on a much darker turn. Because whereas Bruce Wayne is, you know, at least his public face, he's a humanitarian, isn't he? He's a philanthropist, you know, he tries to do good in the world. Whereas this Thomas Wayne, he's sort of turned his back on being a doctor, which he was prior to that fateful night. And he now has plowed the Wayne fortune into, I think it's Wayne Casinos, isn't it? So he controls like the gambling in the city, which kind of is a means to an end because it allows him to, you know, keep a close eye on the criminal activity that comes through his casinos and what have you. So I suppose there is a slightly more noble reason for doing that, but he is the ultimate dark mirror to Bruce, isn't he? He's not in any way like Bruce. He doesn't have Bruce's moral, like you said, because he had no Alfred, so he doesn't have Bruce's moral compass, doesn't he? He's no compunction about crossing the line and taking the life of a criminal, whereas Bruce would never do that in a million years, you know. So it's the ultimate black mirror version, and I love this version of Batman as well. I mean, you know, he's older because it's Thomas, obviously, so he's a generation older than Bruce. He's an older superhero, but yet he still has that mythology around him, doesn't he? That the Bruce has always had, because I think it's referred to multiple times where people are like, I think when Vic tries to recruit into his cause, he says, "If you join me, other people will join me because people believe in the Bat. People believe that you're invincible, you're a myth, you're a legend." So some things die hard, don't they?
Well, I think that's smart. I think that's also, again, the meta commentary from Johns about the DC universe. Again, what we were talking about before is like Batman is the central focus. This is called Flashpoint, but yeah. Thomas Wayne, Batman, is the central. Later in the rebirth with the button, it's again Barry and Bruce together.
Yes.
All roads lead through Bruce now. It used to always be everything has to go through Superman. And while he's still part of the Trinity, you know, with Wonder Woman, it's all Batman is the character that wags, you know, Warner Brothers' dog now. So
yeah.
I think he's also commenting on that, and that in every possible universe, Batman's always going to be the center of it.
Yeah.
As a reader, like if this is a Flashpoint book without Batman, it's still going to be good because we wouldn't know, you know, that's, but of course, John said, no, I'm going to get in there. I'm going to make Batman important. People, like you said, he's a legend. People believe in the Bat people. Yeah. I think it's really smart. And I like this version of him too, because again, like I said, it's Bruce is a dark character as it is, and it can all go one way or the other.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's again, it's like we said, how this version of Superman or Kal-El, we should say, is like that what if version who didn't get the upbringing that he had. This is like, although it isn't Bruce Wayne, as we've discussed, obviously it's not Bruce Wayne, but it's like almost how Bruce Wayne could have turned out post that night, isn't it? You know, without the moral guidance of Alfred, with, you know, without the sort of teachings that he underwent around the world and the training, he could have easily ended up as his father has ended up in this dark continuity, isn't it? He straddles the line sometimes of going that way, doesn't he?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I love that in this universe, it's Vic Stone, who is the bright light.
Yeah.
Superman's taken out, Wonder Woman's taken out, Aquaman's taken out, because they're all villains. You know, they're all villains, Superman's just out. And I love that it's Vic Stone, because I've often said, and I've said to you before, and like he's the role model of the DC universe. Like he's the guy, if you said to a kid, like, be like, if you want to be like a superhero, not like be like a superhero, because he can't, I mean, the only person you could really be like is Batman, but then, of course, you need $1 billion.
Yeah.
You're going to be like a person, a role model. It's Vic Stone. And so I love, too, that they doubled and tripled down on that and this, and are like, Barry says something like, are you bigger? You know, like,
Of course,
this version of Vic is like, what the hell are you talking about? But I just love that the bright light at the center of the darkness is this kid, this genius, tragic figure kid who just never gives up hope. And it's so great that what he's willing to do. He's willing to bend laws and do things because it's everything is for the common good. He's trying to save the world. He needs Thomas Wayne's help. He needs this version of Shazam. What do they call him? Captain Thunder.
Captain Thunder, yeah.
Yeah. And it's just, he knows what his own weaknesses are, but he also knows that being a light, being a bright shining star, like he is, isn't enough. He needs Batman. He needs the legend, because no matter what kind of rousing St. Crispin's Day speech that Vic Stone gives is not going to be enough. I mean, it would be enough for me to follow him, but I know a different version of him. Like I'm a reader, not living in the universe. So I like that too. I like what they've done with him. I think he's great. What did you think of Vic in this? Were you, cause this is, again, this changes sort of Vic's story, and this version of Vic kind of sticks from here on out.
Yeah.
Cause we talked about him in the Titans book, and so I don't know, what do you think of this remade Vic Stone?
Oh, superb. I do remember as well. Yeah. When I think we did Judas Contract, didn't we?
Yeah.
And you were saying then that you've always loved Vic Stone, and he is,
yeah.
I think you mentioned he is the most kind of morally admirable character in the DC universe, isn't he? That he doesn't have, I suppose Superman doesn't either, but Superman's kind of held at a different standard, whereas but Vic, he doesn't have a darker side to him, does he? I mean, based on the things he's been through in life and what's happened to him, you could forgive him for becoming bitter and dark and hating the world and, being resentful. I mean, I think most of us, what if we'd sort of been through the events of what's framed him and what's made him into this, more machine than man almost. But but this version of him is great because, like you said, he is the front and center superhero of the DC universe now, isn't he? He's no longer a supporting character. He's no longer a member of a team. He's very much the government's choice as well, isn't he? We discover that he's working at the pleasure of the president. He's serving at the pleasure of the president, isn't he, in this book, before the president kind of cuts him off and says, look, I've given you all the leeway I can, all the support I can, but it's not quite enough. So, we'll go to DEFCON 5 and off we go, launch our Air Force on Wonder Woman and Aquaman, which is the stupidest fucking move ever, but there you go. What's that going to achieve? But yeah, he is great in this. I mean, it's great to see a character like that given chance to shine. And I think the things that have happened to the character since, not just in the comic book world, but, him being sort of given a bit more of a chance to shine in live action and things, I think maybe this book could have been the tipping point for that, because he puts him in a starring role and says, this character can carry a storyline. We can put this storyline out there, which is a huge, reality jarring event. And like you said, we're taking away your main characters, aren't we? We're sidelining Superman, and we're not giving you the Batman you know and love, and Wonder Woman's this character full of hate. So your traditional, big hitters are not there. So we're going to give you someone who's not been the biggest of hitter, and we're going to make him the absolute shining light of this universe. It's great. I think it works really well. And, Vic Stone's a character that's sort of, he never really worked massively with his solo books. I mean, they've been cancelled. I think his Rebirth book, it did get cancelled, didn't it, after a while, and he's been in, I think, Justice League Odyssey most recently as part of that storyline.
Yeah.
In the Rebirth continuity, he's not in the Justice League anymore, which is a shame. But so as a solo character with his solo book, never quite hit the heights, but which is a shame. But I think, within the context of this book, he works great as a front man. I think he's superb.
Well, I think too, this is what we learn, is he is a good front man. I read his solo book. It was cool to see Detroit actually depicted in a book, being from Michigan. That was cool. But what I I think what we learn here in Justice League Odyssey and in the Justice League, you know, during the New 52, is that he is a leader of a team, and that's where he belongs. You know, maybe that's why his solo books don't work, is because he needs to be the guy who gets the band together and moves them forward and inspires them and drags them across the finish line. And when he's in his own solo story, it's almost like, what could possibly happen? You know, it's like, it's going to have to be some virus and it's all inside him. You know, it's not, I don't know. I just think seeing him as leader of people works a little bit better. And I agree what you're saying is, I think this book is the catalyst for everything, for seeing him in the Justice League, in the movies, on the Doom Patrol show. You know, and I know he's still in Teen Titans Go because that's the original Teen Titans group.
Yeah.
And that's fine. And I think that's a nice nod, you know, to those of us who knew him that way, but he's everywhere. He's across all media. And I definitely think this is the, I agree with you. This is the book that probably did that for him. And so I just love him. I think he's such a great character. And rereading this, it just reminded me again of what he, you know, what a great guy. Just what a cool character that Marvin George invented. Yeah. They gave Nightwing his disco costume, but they invented Dick Stone. You know what I mean? So it's
The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, he's sort of the ultimate dependable character, isn't he? You know what you're going to get from him. You know, you don't have to second guess his character or his motivations. You know how he's going to be straight shooter, straight down the middle. And there's a lot to be said for that, really, especially in sort of the times we live in now as well, with, you know, people in positions of authority not being straight shooters plenty of countries, you know, my country, your country, that's certainly the case.
For sure.
Yeah, it is. So yeah, definitely. I think it's great to see him get his time in the sun in this book. And it, as we said, it works beautifully. It really does.
Yeah.
And another thing that works beautifully, which I always like to touch upon in these shows, is the art in this book. Now, as you said, last time you were on, we did 1602, which was art by Andy Kubert, and said Andy Kubert is back with a vengeance in this book. But I think it's a testament to the versatility of the man that the art in these two books bears no resemblance to each other, does it? I mean, usually you can look at an artist's work and there's very much a consistency, isn't there, through the different books they do. You know, be it someone like Alex Ross, you immediately would look at whatever book he's doing and go, that's Alex Ross. Or Jim Lee or someone like that, you know, going back even further, you know, Jack Kirby or whatever. There's a consistency to their work. Their style is very much defined. Whereas the art in this and the art in 1602, they are literal night and day, aren't they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think it's because he was 100% aware of his time, like what he was doing. 1602 is set in a specific time and place, and he made sure his art matched that time and place, 1602 in England. Yeah. And in this is taking place in 2011 in a hellscape. And so he's like, okay, well, you know, how do I accommodate that? So yeah, he I think that is a testament to his skills. And again, I love being able to look and go, ooh, that's a McFarlane, that's Jim Lee. Like just being able to look at it and know, oh, like Adriana Mello is a artist right now. And her, if I see it and I know it's her, she's like got such a distinct style and I love her style. But I agree that like, I almost forgot that this was him. This is Kubert reading this until I was like, oh, right, shit, he's that good that he disappears. And I think that is a testament to his version of storytelling that he's going to give the writer what is needed for the story instead of it being the other way around, where it's like, well, you're going to hire so-and-so to do your art, so that's the kind of book you're going to get. He's like, I'm going to give you the book that you've written. And I think that shows off how good he is.
Oh, definitely. I think I remember when we did 1602, we remarked on how little, inverted commas, action there was in that book. You know, it's very much a dialogue-driven Machiavellian plot, and there is very little physical conflict in it. However, this book is wall-to-wall physical conflict, isn't it? And the way he depicts that action, there's so many great splash moments in this, and the fights are hard hitting and you really do feel the blows. You know, the way he depicts Barry when he's been literally fried alive in a makeshift electric chair trying to get his power back.
To get his powers back. Yeah, it's such a great scene.
It is great, isn't it? You know, one failed attempt, but then second attempt somehow works when the first one didn't, but there you go. We said it's night and day, is that? But again, in this book, there's so much of a physical kinetic quality to it, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think because any flash book, you have to, I mean, you can't go into a flash book and say they're going to stand around. I mean, and that's what's cool too, is that, you know, Barry, when he doesn't have his powers, he falls and he does things. And then that scene, like you're talking about the electric chair scene, it's so powerful. And yeah, there's tons of splash pages. And I think this one, and there's like war fight scenes and all this other stuff happening. So it's like full of action. So it is, it's like a completely different book. And again, I forgot it was the same guy until I started reading it. And I was like, oh, right, that's amazing. And I forget how good he is. He did a lot of that early Wolverine stuff that I read, you know, and so and that's such a distinct, his version of Wolverine is such a distinct look. Yeah. He's really great. He is really amazing. And again, I think like you said, the way that it's every page is bursting with energy, a potential something. Whereas like you said, in 1602, it's like he draws it in a way that you feel okay, that everybody's just kind of standing around. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it is. It literally feels like something's about to pop off, doesn't it? On every page, you know, that sense like the world is on a knife edge. And we were talking before about that theme of this being a race against time. There's the art, I don't know, maybe I'm seeing what I want to see, but it almost seems to like convey that sense of urgency in the way he draws. I don't know. It really works well for the story.
I totally agree. I think that's exactly well said. I think he's capturing some sense of urgency. That's well said. I love it. I love it. I think it's so good. And like I said, it's a testament that I forgot it was him until I opened it again. And again, not because it was an immemorable art, but because it's so unique from the last thing of his I just read. Yeah. You're like, oh, damn.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's amazing. I think, and I was actually talking, because we talked about Judd Winnick before, and I was talking about him, recently about how, you know, what he does when he draws his superhero stuff is so different than when he draws his like middle reader stuff. And that ability to go from like cartoony to like superhero-y is impressive. And Kubert's, you know, ability to like draw this old timey, you know, thing where it's unreal. It's just really, it's great work. I appreciate everything he did.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, I think that helps with I was talking before about the rereadability factor of this, how I can keep coming back to it year on year. And I think the art plays a huge part in that as well as the, like we said, the brilliantly written story and the gripping nature of it. The art, there's so much for you to feast your eyes on. And with the sheer depth of characters that crop up in it as well, in these splash pages, your eyes are naturally drawn to the main protagonists in the middle. Like there's a great shot of Barry and Thorn clashing together in full costume, but then in the background there's, you know, two dozen other characters who've barely played a part in this whole story, yet they're fully fleshed DC characters, and there they are in the background fighting away. It's really great to see.
Yeah, it is. And that's amazing. Like you said, Grifter shows up, and then there's that big panel scene later where you see like the Vertigo universe, the Wildstorm universe all kind of coming together. And it doesn't really make sense when you first see it. You're like, well, Barry's running through all these things and the universe is changing. And like Swamp Thing shows up in that panel for no reason. He's not in it anywhere else. And you're like, wait, what's going on? And his version of Swamp Thing, Kubert's version of Swamp Thing is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
It's just really, it's amazing. And it's an amazing, the characters that they let him have for just half a second. Demon. I love Demon. And you forget about him. And he's in this just in a couple of panels and he has a couple of lines, but it's such a cool character to see in Kubert's version of him. And again, that felt like that jumped right out of like the Golden Age.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. It just ties into what we've been saying all the way through. There's so much depth to the world that he's created. And again, that's the strength of him being able to pull characters seemingly out of nowhere and put them in there, and you're like, oh shit, where's he come from? And
I know,
you know, I forgot he even existed. Yeah. That is great. And yeah, it's a book that just demands repeat reading. It's you can read it just once and thoroughly enjoy it and thoroughly get it and thoroughly understand what's going on. But I think if you reread it more than once, you get so much more out of it, won't you? Just because of what's going on. And
I'm so glad I read it again recently. You know, I reread it for this. And I was like, I probably could have just gone from memory, but I didn't, you know, I got it out and read it again. I'm so glad, because I would have, this conversation would, we wouldn't have gone down all our rabbit holes. I wouldn't have thought about all these things if I hadn't.
Yeah.
It's so good. And I would recommend, you know, obviously we'll do this in a second, but it's so good. I really think everybody, doesn't matter where you are in time, whether you're reading it as a new reader or whether, you know, like this doesn't exist anymore in the new continuity because of Rebirth, it doesn't matter. It's just as its own 5-issue story arc, even without those back issues, those other side stories. It's a tight, like you said, it's just, it's such a, it's like a nerd's dream.
Yeah. Oh, it is definitely. Yeah. Something for everyone in there, I would say.
There's no doubt. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's definitely something for us. So what we'll do is now we'll, as always, at the end of these shows, we like to sort of give our final scores out of 5. Guest always has the last word, as it should always be. So I'm going to, for me, I've got to give it 5, Tony. It has to be 5 out of 5 for me. I think it's a true event comic. I love the alternate reality and the detail of that world. As someone who loves, as we've said, I love Elseworlds stories. So although, as we've said, this is not Elseworlds, but it kind of takes the same premise of an Elseworlds story. So I adore this dark take on the continuity. It's just stands up to repeat reading so well and has something new for you to notice every time. And whilst the new 52 might be somewhat divisive, the way they executed transitioning to it here was absolutely flawless and superb. I adore this book. I always will. It's 5 out of 5 for me every day of the week and twice on Sundays. What about you, sir?
I just echo everything that you're saying. And again, like you said, the fact that this, you didn't know when you first read this was going to launch a whole new universe, but it did. Of course, it was Barry Allen. Of course, Wally West brings Rebirth. I mean, we learn later it's Dr. Manhattan, but we see Wally West. It's always a flash, right? It was a flash of two worlds. So I love that nod to the past while bringing you into the future. And it's always a flash who does it. So while, you know, the acknowledgement that it always, Bruce Wayne, or a Batman is always going to be the center of the DC universe, this was like a love letter to Flash, and that the character of the Flash is always going to be important. Historically, Flash saved the world in Crisis. Barry Allen. So it's just such a nice nod back to Crisis. It's really, I love it. 5 out of 5, Kubert. Like, again, I forgot it was Kubert. That's how good he is. He just disappears into the book and you feel like it's real. And if you've never read Flashpoint, read Flashpoint, even though we've done some spoilery stuff, doesn't matter. Cause like you said, there's stuff in the background that you didn't even know was there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a great book. And you know, the title of this show is Mandatory Marvel and DC. And I could not think of a more mandatory title for someone to read than this one. So thank you again, Tony, for suggesting such a great book. As always, with every guest that comes on here, the treats they line up for me are fantastic with what they say we want to talk about. So this show is a privilege to do. And it is, as always, Tony, an absolute privilege to have you on. I really appreciate
that. Thank you, sir. Like I said, before we started talking, it's been great to know you and to get to know everybody on the show and the network. And it's just been a treat. I love this. Anytime you say, let's get together, I'm on. And, you know, we will talk soon about you coming on sometime over December when I've got more time in my schedule to do Alien v Predator on my show. That's going to be a good time.
It is indeed. Yeah, I look forward to that, as I always do whenever we get together on a show. I very much look forward to it. So
I'll time my life better for that one.
yeah.
The short notice on, I didn't realize my time. I'm sorry.
No worries, sir. No worries. So obviously, as always, Tony, let the listeners know where they can find you on social media and find everything you've got going on.
Well, sure. I'm on this very network on every Friday, Indie Comic Spotlight.
Yep.
I have got stuff coming up. Dave's been on. We're going to cover The Boys. I've got some creators coming on. I've got Mark Russell and Dan Waters. And it's just it's a great time. Yeah. It's very exciting. So that's on Fridays. You can follow me on Twitter at Tricycle Boombox. You can read my stuff on DC Comics News. I do say Fantastic Universes, although it's been a while. I've got a couple of things in the pike that I will dump on Steve over my month off that I have a month off for work because my university is shut down for the holidays. So that'll be exciting. And half of December and half of January, I'll just have time to be creative and do stuff. So I'm looking forward to that. And you can go to my website, arfarina.com. And actually, I was just asked today by a guy I wrote some songs with, and you can get links to those videos at my website. A couple of the songs I wrote with him, he just sent me an email today wanting to get together and write some new songs. So over Christmas break, I'll be writing some new songs too. So that'll be fun.
Wow, a true Renaissance man in every sense of the word.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant. Well, certainly a lot to come from the Farina camp over the coming week. So I, like everyone else, will be looking forward to that. That's definitely the case.
Thank you.
Yeah. If you want to find me on Twitter, I'm at Maxi Byrne, which is spelled M-A-X-Y-B-Y-R-N-E. If you go there, there's links to the various websites I write reviews and articles for, and obviously links to this wonderful Comics in Motion network feed, which houses obviously this show, Tony's show, and a whole host of other shows. There's a great selection of content on there, something for everyone's taste. So by all means, check out Comics in Motion in your podcast capturing app. You'll find it, and then you'll be listening to a lot of great content over the coming weeks and months, and hopefully years. So by all means,
hopefully years. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll survive 2020. We've got another month and a half. We can do it, man.
Yeah. If we've got through this year, we can get through any year. That's for sure.
That's right.
Yeah. So thank you, Tony, once again.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you.
It's always good to talk to you, man.
And you, my pleasure. And everyone out there, keep safe, keep looking out for each other. And, soon, hopefully, the world will be something resembling what it used to be, and we won't be living in this flashpoint reality living in right now. Yeah. So thank you so much to everyone for listening. See you again soon. All the best. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye.
Tony Farina of DC Comics News and Fantastic Universes. I want to invite you to join me every Friday on the feeds of Comics in Motion, where I will be joined by excellent guests to do a deep dive in an indie comic from a company other than the big two. Sometimes I'm joined by the creators themselves, and other times I'm joined by my geek friends who love to talk about all things comics. Either way, you'll have a great time hearing about some books you may have missed. Please join me on Indie Comic Spotlight every Friday on Comics in Motion.